It is an honor to be here, and I just got really emotional in the worship. I came to faith here 42 years ago as a teenager, and so it's pretty awesome to be here. And God has been faithful this whole 42 years, so it's an honor to share about what he's up to in our lives right now. New Story Community is a supportive recovery program designed to promote the flourishing of Indigenous women in a place of safety, beauty, and community. We run a six-month cohort program that begins or continues a healing journey from both lived and intergenerational trauma and the substance misuse caused by this trauma. But it's so much more than this. It's about laughing and crying together. It's about facing fears and stepping towards them. It's about learning you need to feel to heal. It's about discovering identity, both as an Indigenous woman and as a child of God. It's about building new relationships and, where safe, repairing broken ones. It's about finding meaning, purpose, gifts, and strengths. It's about setting goals and working towards them. It's about true reconciliation. It's about writing a new story. We've run three cohorts on Keats Island, where we partner with Barnabas Family Ministries. And our program consists of two main parts. The first part is working on the healing and gaining healthy life skills. We use a faith-based but science-informed recovery manual, which removes the stigma and shame of addiction and provides proven steps to recovery and relapse prevention. The second part is learning job skills while working at Barnabas. Our women work in all areas of the retreat center, harvesting fruit and vegetables, preparing those vegetables into nutritious and delicious meals, serving those meals to guests, and preparing five-star guest rooms. New Story works because it's small, it's intimate, it's community healing. Our participants come from right across Canada, and we honor their culture and seek connection with their home communities. We never want any one New Story to be more than five or six women, but our desire is to see locations multiply across Canada. We're currently working on a partnership with Camp Caroline in Alberta and plan to open there this fall. But our big dream this summer is to purchase a home in the North Okanagan, which we plan to use as our Okanagan New Story location, as well as a training and equipping site. We're looking at a potential property right now, and we appreciate your prayers because this is beyond, this is a God-sized ask and dream, but it's very exciting. We know he's up to something. Before colonization, Indigenous women were the most revered and honored peoples in North America. They were the life givers and the wisdom keepers. Since colonization, they've become the most marginalized and oppressed peoples, as evidenced by the number of missing and murdered Indigenous women. But as Indigenous women are healed, whole communities begin to heal. New Story is committed to seeing this happen, one woman at a time. In Luke 10, Jesus shares the parable of the Good Samaritan in response to the religious leader's question, "Who is my neighbor?" We know the story. Two very religious people pass by the injured man, but it's the outsider, the Samaritan, who provides the help. Jesus responds, "Go and do likewise." Indigenous peoples are our closest but often most neglected neighbors. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission has requested that for true reconciliation to happen, it's time we become good neighbors. Would you join us in helping remove shame, restore dignity, and bring hope to help write a new story, not only for the women who come into our program, but for everyone who steps past their fear and builds reconciling relationships with our Indigenous neighbors. Thank you.
Well, good morning. It's very good to be back here after, of course, we've attended services, but this is the first time I've ever been in this pulpit to do this, so thanks for trusting me with that. Yeah, 42 years ago, I was just barely out of my teens, and Cheryl was still in. We came to faith, and I guess, is that the baptismal tank somewhere? Anyhow, it used to be more visible, and we're baptized in this church. Know many of the Calvary aristocracy. we ourselves were, but the Richardsons and the Barkmans and many others, so the Stutters. My sister-in-law is here today, Leslie, and here's a cool thing. Is it 81 you were married? First wedding in this new building. This was new in 81. So the very first wedding. So we have some history with you. And so thank you for this opportunity. Thank you, Pastor Dave. Dave and I do have, he took a course a few years ago at Regent with me, and we also, a couple years ago, connected again at a pastor event in, I think it was Middle Earth, but they call it Malibu. But I don't know, we kind of went through this weird kind of time warp. So I'm not sure it's actually on the planet. It's a pretty cool place. I want to read right now a text that has become central and foundational to the work that Cheryl and I do with New Story. This thing God put in our heart and insisted on, you know how God does that? To promote the flourishing of these very brave, amazing women in this place of safety, beauty, and community. And the text, I think, will become clear to you pretty much as I start reading it, is about eyes to see people that sometimes we have lost the eyes to see. Passages in Luke's Gospel, chapter 7, beginning in verse 36. I'm going to read from the New International Version. Luke 7:36. Now one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him. So he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. When a woman who had lived a sinful life in that town learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster jar of perfume, and as she stood behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. When the Pharisee who had invited Jesus saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he'd know who's touching him and what kind of woman she is. She's a sinner. And Jesus answered him. Does Jesus ever answer your thoughts? Jesus answered him, Simon, I have something to tell you. Oh, tell me, teacher, he said. Well, two men owed money to a certain money lender. One owed him 500 denarii and the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back. So he canceled the debts of both. Now, which of him will love him more? Simon replied, I suppose the one who had the bigger debt canceled. Oh, you've judged correctly, Jesus said. Then he turned toward the woman and said to Simon, just get the physical dynamics. The woman is actually behind Jesus. Now he turns toward her and turns his back on Simon. Do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me any water from my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman from the time I entered has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she's poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, for she loved much, but he who has been forgiven little loves little. And Jesus said to her, well, your sins are forgiven. The other guests began to say, well, among themselves, who's this? Who's this who even forgives sins? And Jesus said to the women, your faith has saved you. You go in peace. It bothers me that Jesus never tells us her name. At the beginning of the Gospel of Luke, Luke presents himself as a very careful historian. We know he's a medical doctor, but he also claims that he is a somewhere between a careful historian and an investigative journalist. He's gone back, he's got eyewitness accounts from whoever he could get eyewitness accounts to get the fullest, most complete, most accurate story of Jesus' works and days. He knows the guy's name, and he doesn't tell us her name. Has she not lived enough just with her reputation? Can he not say her name? Now, the tradition is she's Mary of Magdala. In fact, the very next chapter, right after this, he names Mary, Luke does, and he says that Mary Magdala followed Jesus, one of these group of amazing women, and out from her, Jesus had cast out seven demons. And so if this is actually Mary, and also the tradition around Mary Magdalene or Mary of Magdala, she was a prostitute. Maybe she's got enough stacked up against her that Luke's just giving her a little moment of anonymity here. I don't know, but he doesn't name her. Would you mind if I called her Chelsea? Chelsea was one of the women that you saw in the slideshow, and with her permission, she wants us to tell her story, because in it is life. Chelsea was the very first woman who showed up. She was in her early 20s, showed up at our program. In fact, for the first month, 3 years ago when we started News Story, she was the only woman. When she arrived, she had been living on the streets for 6 years with a heroin addiction, and the kind of scrounging, scavenging, stealing, doing whatever you must to keep yourself alive and your addiction fed. 6 years. She had rotted teeth, everyone. They all had to be pulled. Her hair was bicked right down to the skull because of preventing lice. She was under 100 pounds and sick all over. She looked like, honestly, somebody who had just walked out of Auschwitz. She was really angry. We'd done an intake interview a month before and then insisted that she go to detox for 28 days because we weren't ready to kind of handle what she was bringing. She had no memory of the intake interview on the morning she woke up, the first morning. She was just angry and full of venom, and she cussed Cheryl out, and I'll give this to Chelsea. She can, in those days, she could cuss in a way that would make sailors and loggers blush. Cussed Cheryl out, announced very loudly that she didn't believe in the God that we believed in, nor did she want to. And she was going to be leaving that afternoon in the next boat out. I'll pick up her story at the end. It began a deep education for Cheryl and I in something that had been academic up to that point. I call it the 2 Corinthians 5:16 education. That's where the Apostle Paul, 2 Corinthians 5:16, is talking about one of the key fruits, maybe the key fruit, of transformation in Christ. When you come to Christ, when you get converted, when Christ lands in your heart,
The reordering of your life, Paul suggests, starts with something and it never ends. You start to see people differently. This is what he says in 2 Corinthians 5:16. For we no longer look at anyone from a worldly point of view. Katasarx is a Greek meaning according to the flesh. We've stopped using labels, Paul says. We've stopped trapping people in their past, in their reputation, in the story going around about them. We actually see the person. And isn't that Paul's story? I mean, here's this little fusty Pharisee. I just came up with that. That's cool. No, can you write that down? It's a fusty Pharisee. I mean, that guy was as narrow as a human could get. And his narrowness when he was a Pharisee all had to do with how he saw people. It was tunnel visioned. It was myopic. It was black and white. You were either in or out. And it was very hard to get in with Paul. He was angry. Anyone who didn't agree with him, look like him, dress like him, talk like him, think like him, he was trying to get you arrested. And his preference is just get you killed. Going around, crusading around the world to impose his vision of how it should be on the world. And what does the Lord do when he knocks him down on the road to Damascus? He blinds him because he has to rearrange his whole sight. Remember that beautiful phrase in Acts 9 when Ananias comes and prays for him and it says, and it was like scales coming off his eyes? Ouch. These things being peeled back, of course, because he had to have surgery and he had to have his eyes rearranged. And I imagine the moment when Paul opened his eyes after the Lord had spoken to him, revealed himself to him in that blinding light, that he looks and he can't believe this is the world he's inhabited because he can't believe how beautiful it is. And I think he's just looking at, he probably staggers out into the street and he sees people that before he would look at with scorn and derision and have a label for, and you are one of those. And suddenly he's like, oh my goodness. And in 2 Corinthians, he says, when we get saved, it's ophthalmological, not theological. Our eyesight changes. We start to see the whole world and people especially. We start to see them. And if we see them, then we actually want the best for them. We want them to be reconciled to God. Do you know that you can actually just measure the difference between a Pharisee and a disciple in terms of their eyesight? Isn't that the work that Jesus did with those first disciples? It's not an easy work. I mean, those guys are just chock-a-block full of their prejudice against Samaritans and blind people or whatever. Like, it's just like they're wanting to run the show. And Jesus keeps basically having to tear the scales from their eyes. Do you see this person in front of you? Do you see that they're a child? You know, Jesus doesn't really deal in labels. He calls you by name, and there's another thing he does. He gives you a title. You know what his favorite titles are? Son and daughter. Story after story in the gospel where some woman who's not seen, who's seen in all the wrong ways, pushes 12 years of suffering from a dread disease that makes her unclean among everything she touches and everyone. And she pushes herself, grabs heel to the hem of the robe, and Jesus, who touched me? I felt the power. Go out of me. Somebody really needs this. And she comes trembling, and it was me. And his first word out of his mouth is, oh, daughter. That man who gets lowered down the roof in Capernaum on the gurney, and he's paralyzed in all limbs, and Jesus' first word out of his mouth is, son. You see, the scene that Jesus wants to birth in us is away from the labeling of people to the true naming of them, the true seeing of them, and if we're going to give them anything that is beyond their name, it's going to be a son, daughter, it's going to be a title. And the irony of this story that I read here in Luke 7 is that the one person who thinks he can see with X-ray vision, 20/20 vision, is Simon. It's all about seeing. He's watching Jesus, and there's lots of wondering and speculating among commentators about, was this scene even set up? Did he try to trip Jesus up and pay this woman, and the woman then was overcome with real emotion and real gratitude toward Jesus? Who knows? But there's a sense where it's a setup. Simon invites Jesus to his house because he's trying to assess, he's trying to suss out something about Jesus. Is he really a prophet? That's the most he's going to give him. And this woman comes in, and the basis on which Simon concludes that Jesus simply can't be more than some wandering healer or something, the only basis is that Jesus can't see her, according to Simon. If Jesus knew who this woman was, if he could really see, if he was clued in, if he was dialed in to the what's really happening here, he would know who is touching him, and he would go, ooh, stop it. Simon thinks he sees the woman, and he thinks he sees Jesus. And his designation, his verdict on the woman is she's a sinner, and the verdict on Jesus is he's not a prophet. Now, that irony that Simon is one who thinks he is the only one who can see clearly, it may go deeper, and I'll tell you why. There's two other stories, one in Mark and one in Matthew, that bear an uncanny resemblance to this story. Scholars debate whether they're different stories or the same story, but in the story in Matthew 26 and Mark 14, we have a story of a woman coming, breaking a jar, washing Jesus' feet. The focus in those stories is not on so much on the woman, it's more on the disciples getting all twisted up about the waste of the perfume being poured out, could have been sold, given to the poor. But here's the interesting thing. It's a dinner party. A woman comes, breaks the alabaster jar, pours the perfume out, and the name of the host is the same, Simon, except in Matthew and Mark's gospel, rather than Luke's, he's not called Simon the Pharisee. Does anybody know what he's called in Matthew and Mark? Simon the leper. Huh. Now, that's not a nickname you pick up unless there's a backstory. Like, nobody's just saying, oh, you look a little pale. We're going to call you leper. Here's a possibility. It's just sheer speculation. Let's say Simon the Pharisee and Simon the leper are the same person. And let's say that Simon the Pharisee once had leprosy, which means he would have been banished from the community, a complete outsider, unclean, and he would not be included in the hope of Israel. He was cast out. He was an outcast. And let's say that the reason he's curious about Jesus is that, like in the story that we come to in Luke 17, he's one of those lepers that begs Jesus, come touch me. And Jesus does, and he gets healed, but he never goes back to check it out. That's the story in Luke 17. Let's say Jesus did a bunch of those, healing of lepers, and some people just thought, hot diggity, I'm back, I can go to Starbucks again, hold my daughter again. Whoever that guy was, cool, awesome. Let's say he was one of a leper that somehow got, and now he's just curious. Jesus is in town. He says, let's bring Jesus to my house, and we'll just see, is he more than just this itinerant healer? And he decides on the basis of Jesus letting this woman touch him, come near to him, no, he can't be. And dismissed. You know what, though? I don't think Simon the leper and Simon the Pharisee could be the same person. I'll tell you why. Could anybody have been touched by Jesus where you once were on the outside and now you're on the inside? Could any of you ever have been touched by Jesus, by his grace, his goodness, his love in that way, and not pay it forward? No, that wouldn't happen, would it? So they can't be the same guy. That was just a bad theory, sorry. Jesus wants Simon to see truly. Simon thinks he sees, and Jesus really wants to help him see. He wants to tear scales from Simon's eyes. And so he does that by asking two questions. The first is embedded in a story about new beginnings. Someone has something to tell you. Oh, tell me, what's that? Well, there's two men. It's interesting that there's a woman washing Jesus' feet behind him. Simon is judging, but Jesus starts with a story about men who need some debt canceled. There's two men, and one owed this amount and one owed that amount. Neither had the ability to pay. So the person who was owed the money just said, forget about it. Forget about it. Just canceled it. And then the question comes, who would love him more? Who would love the person who forgave the debt, canceled the debt more? And Simon responds, I suppose the one who had the bigger debt canceled. Jesus, you've answered correctly, but which is honestly the fondest wish of a Pharisee to answer, get the correct answer. I think it's a trick question, don't you? It's got to be a trick question. Of course, if you've got 500 denarii forgiven over 50, the 500, forgiveness is going to. It's a trick question because Jesus, I don't think, is talking about amounts needing forgiving. He's talking about percents. The key phrase in that little story is neither had the ability to pay. If you don't have the ability to pay, it doesn't matter how big the debt is, the amount. How much forgiveness do you need? How much cancellation of debt do you need if you can't? It's 100%. It's not a matter of who got the bigger debt canceled. It's a matter of who could see that they needed the 100% no matter how socially you were positioned. And maybe you were born into sort of good stock, good family, good upbringing, good schooling, all of that. And no, you never did some heinous crime. But you still, anybody here when they came to Jesus just got like a little topping up? Jesus, I'm good for, if I could just get 10% here, we're good. Is anyone here didn't need 100% cancellation of the debt? Yeah, I think that the trick question is, but do you see it? Do you see it? Do you see that your indebtedness to God and His graciousness in canceling 100%, the whole thing, is equal to the person who's committed the worst sins, the worst crimes, that God also canceled his debt, that your cancellation of debt like theirs is 100%. And the real question is, if you can see that, you understand that you're going to love radically, extravagantly. And if you don't see that, you're just going to, there's going to be a stinginess in us. So Jesus tries to get Simon to see by asking this first question embedded in a story about new stories, it's new beginnings. You get to start again. Your past doesn't follow you around once the debt gets canceled. You can live into a whole new identity. You can live into a whole new way of being. It's a new story. Jesus asks the question, who would love more? And though Simon answers correctly, he misses the whole point of it. So Jesus tries another thing to totally get his attention and have the scales fall from Simon's eyes. It's a very direct question. Simon, do you see this woman? Let's say the physical dynamics is this woman is behind Jesus washing his feet, and Jesus now turns full to her, engages with her, turns his back on Simon, and simply says, do you see her? Or is it your labels? Is it your verdict about what she's done and who she is and the reputation she has? I bet you Simon knew her name and didn't want to say it. Some years ago, was in the country of Bolivia, and in central Bolivia, there's a beautiful town called Cochabamba. And to my great joy and surprise, when I got to Cochabamba, I discovered that towering over the city on a high ridge above the city is a Christ that's virtually a replica of the Christ in Rio, the Christ the Redeemer statue, this beautiful alabaster, really, beckoning, welcoming, cruciform, come unto me. The one in Cochabamba, Bolivia is 1 meter taller, so there's some kind of competition going on there. But I'm with a friend, and he said, do you want to go see it's called Christos de la Concordia, the Christ of Unity. Do you want to go see go up to and stand at the feet of Jesus? I'm all in. So switch back roads, get up there, run up. I'm in awe looking up at this massive Jesus welcoming the world, dying for the world. And then my friend says to me, do you want to go in Jesus? I got a bit of a Tom Sawyer thing in me. So we go over, and to my great dismay, there's this, it's a little door. Even me in my stature, I would have to crouch to get in it, but it's padlocked shut. And he says, oh, I guess it's closed today. And I'm honestly thinking, should I kick the door down? Like, what is that, that they break the roof to get me? Is this a crime against, this monument if I just kick the door down to get into Jesus? But I go away disappointed. Don't get into Jesus. A couple of years later, I'm back in the same town, same friend. Do you want to go see Jesus? Yes, I do. Drive up, and to my overwhelming euphoria, Jesus is open today. And not even charging. You don't have to pay to get into Jesus. It's just amazing. So we go into Jesus, and I go under the little door that seems, you have to bow down to go in. And inside, they told me, no, it's very specific. Don't get wandering around. There's these spiral stairs going up, 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 up. About every 10 feet, there's a scaffolding of boards, of planks that you can stand at various levels in Jesus. And in front of his body and behind his body, these little sort of face-sized portholes, you can look out and see the countryside. As you climb into Jesus, you can see the sort of the way the land falls away on both sides. So I go up. I look on all four portholes. I look at the valleys and the forests and whatnot. You can see the city over there. Finally, I get to that place. It's the last scaffolding inside Jesus, and it's right at heart level. And I realize that they've placed a porthole right where the heart is. So I go and look at the other three first, and I save the best for last. I step up and I look through this window, this porthole out into the countryside, and I realize, I don't know if it was a architectural fluke or it was planned all along, but it's only really there at the heart of Jesus that you can see the entire city of Cochabamba spread out before you. And I had a revelation that this is actually a parable of discipleship. That we go higher up and further in, higher up and further in, higher up and further in. We keep going toward the very heart of Jesus. And when finally we have got the heart of Jesus, we see everything, everything, and everything from that heart. You see the people that you love and the people that you don't love, the people who have hurt you. You see the people you work with, the people that you wish you didn't work with. You see your own life. You see everything through the heart of Jesus. Simon, do you see this woman? Do you see her through my heart? Because you know what I see, dude? You really suck at hospitality. You don't know how to welcome anybody. Yeah, you've put out the spread, you've got the roast duck or whatever, you've put out the food, but I, looking at this woman, and this is lavish, extravagant, radical hospitality. You see, what love does when we have been transformed, when we see as Jesus sees, as this is the story of Paul too, you stop resisting and judging the world and you start saying, bring them all in. You are so welcome. Yes. And not only does this woman pour out hospitality toward Jesus that Simon has neglected, Jesus pours out hospitality to her. And he just wants to boot her out. You see, when we've been really transformed by the love of Jesus and we start to see as he sees this alteration, the scales fall, and we no longer look at anyone from a worldly point of view. Then what we want to do is say to them, come on in. And that's actually Paul, 2 Corinthians 5, no evangelism happens until that happens in our heart. You can have all the programs. You can hire somebody to do that. Nothing will happen until we're actually looking at everyone through the heart of Jesus. Do you see this woman? Let me finish up here with where Chelsea's at now. Can you put the picture of Chelsea up? I wish it was a little, it's a little blurry. This is actually a year ago. Chelsea looks even more amazing now. Chelsea could be a model now. I remember I told you she was bicked her hair. I have never seen more gorgeous hair in my life. Oh my God. And I'm a hair expert. We worked with a dentist in Gibson's, and he pulled the teeth, all the rotted teeth, but he kept her jaw, and he put all, it took thousands, tens of thousands of dollars. People were so generous, and months and months and months of work, and now she has an unbelievable smile. She's, as you can see, she's thriving, she's healthy. She's a beautiful human. And here's the cool thing. 6 years on the street with a heroin addiction day and whatever it took to keep that addiction alive and stay alive. She now looks after children. She's a child care worker. And the people who actually know her story take their 18-month-old babies and put them in her arms and say, would you look after them? We almost missed that because we didn't at first see her. And we certainly didn't at first see her through the heart of Jesus. And because the Lord did a work in us and is doing a work in us and has been and will continue, I think, lifelong pulling the scales from her eyes, we got with her and several other women. You saw a lot of their photos. That wasn't even the whole. We haven't got the more recent. We've got to watch the transforming miracle of God over and over and over. Women get new stories. So this thing in Luke chapter 7, it ends with Jesus giving this woman, I'm calling her Chelsea, a benediction. He leaves with a benediction. Simon's not about to give her one. And the benediction is, your faith has saved you, go in peace, go in shalom. Here's what I worry about for this woman in the story, and I worry about for women like Chelsea. Chelsea's in a good place, in a good community. We'll see her actually this afternoon. This is what I worry about, is Jesus is sending this woman out into a world that is full of people who will not see her. They just don't have eyes to see. They've still got the scales on. They've still got their labels ready to put on people. World full of Simons. And Jesus said says to this one, go in peace, go in shalom. Go live in the fullness of God's purposes and plans for you. Go there. So I don't know, I get worried. I mean, where's that? Where can she go? 42 years ago, my wife and I, not even married then, came to faith here. And we're well loved and well nurtured and well rooted in the faith and the Word of God. Calvary Baptist of Coquitlam. This is my belief in you and my charge to you. Can she come here? And will you see this woman? Thank you.